Hello, welcome to Popcorn Science. In this podcast, we take a critical look at the science portrayed in our favorite movies and television shows. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Catherine Niche. I'm a planetary geologist and a fan of pop culture.
And I'm Dr. John Moores, a professor of space engineering at York University, a planetary atmospheric scientist, and just a huge speculative fiction nerd.
So this week was my choice, and I went with a classic, the 1993 movie Jurassic Park. Now, as you probably have noticed over the past 15 episodes, John and I are not biologists by training. So this week, we're actually very happy to have a guest with us, Dr. Anne Revel. Anne, welcome to the podcast. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, absolutely. So excited to be here. I am a professor at Midwestern University down in Arizona. I am not a huge science movie person, but I'm super excited to get to talk about some of the science that's going on in this movie today.
Yes, so we're hoping Anne can correct all our errors when we get to the science cripes and the science shine, since I think everything John and I know about dinosaurs, we either learned when we were six or just recently read about on the internet. So
always good to have an expert assist. Thanks so much for being here,
Anne. Absolutely. Yeah.
If you've been living under a rock for the past 30 years and you're not familiar with Jurassic Park, this is a movie about a Walt Disney-like character who creates a theme park filled with live dinosaurs that he reconstructed from DNA found in mosquitoes trapped in amber. In the movie, the park is nearing completion, so he invites a team of scientists and his grandchildren to experience his so-called Jurassic Park. But while they're there, many problems occur that lead to a number of gruesome deaths at the hands of the dinosaurs. This really is a classic movie, though, that encourages the viewer to consider the limitations of scientific progress and the ability of humans to control nature.
I'll tell you the problem with the scientific power that you're using here. It didn't require any discipline to attain it. You know, you read what others had done, and you took the next step. You didn't earn the knowledge for yourselves, so you don't take any responsibility for it. You stood on the shoulders of geniuses to accomplish something as fast as you could, and before you even knew what you had, you patented it and packaged it and slapped it on a plastic lunchbox, and now you're selling it. You want to sell it. Well,
I don't think you're giving us our due credit. Our scientists have done things which nobody's ever done before.
Yeah, but your scientists were so preoccupied with whether or not they could, they didn't stop to think if they should.
This was a movie that I remember being very big. I was 12 years old when this came out, or almost 12, I think. And it was like the first blockbuster I can really remember with all the marketing and the movie posters. And I'm sure I saw it in the theaters that summer. I don't think I've seen it since, so I got to revisit it here more recently, but it's clearly invaded our cultural zeitgeist. My children have been playing Lego Jurassic Park on the Switch for the past few years, so it's everywhere these days over the past 30 plus years. John, Anne, what's your history with this movie?
Well, for my part, I do remember it being really big. I didn't see this one in theaters. Unfortunately, I waited for the perhaps less good sequel to this one. Oof. Before, you know, seeing the big screen. But even on a small TV, it was something spectacular. At the same time, I think I just took it as entertainment. It wasn't something that really changed, you know, my pathway or anything like that, even though it was a very formative time. And I think you experienced a bit of that too.
Yeah, and I am certain that I saw the movie at some point because I definitely remembered bits and pieces when I was rewatching it in prep for this. But I don't remember, sort of like John, it having any sort of major impact for me. And that might be because at that time I was living out in the countryside and it was 20 or 30 minutes to get into a movie theater. And I certainly wasn't old enough to be driving at that point. So maybe I didn't get out to see it in the theaters for those reasons and watched it at some other point. But other than, again, like you said, those references that we kind of have come up, it didn't make a huge impact for me either.
Yeah, it's funny. We're all at the right age for being influenced by this and being inspired to become paleontologists, and yet none of us did. As we were talking about off mic, you know, I think I'd already been pretty obsessed with space by that point, so the dinosaurs couldn't grip me as much as the sci-fi and space movies I was seeing at the time.
But you do impacts now, right? So you've got dinosaurs in space together.
That's right. That's right. You know, the dinosaur killing impact, or so they claim. We still don't really know what killed the dinosaurs, but certainly that impact did not help. And we'll talk a little bit about that as we get into the science gripes and the science shine. Shall we move into those? So again, this is coming from two space scientists and a physiologist. But I think we can talk intelligently about some of the things this movie got right and wrong. So in terms of science gripes, I'll turn it over to our guest. Anne, what was the biggest thing that stood out to you in this movie?
Well, I mean, the biggest thing would be the fact that the DNA that they were getting from mosquitoes to create these dinosaurs almost certainly is an impossibility. DNA half-life, so how long it takes for DNA to be broken down, means that there would essentially be no DNA left after something like 6.8 million years, and that is way younger than the dinosaurs that they were trying to recreate in this movie.
Yeah, I read something about how DNA breaks down really quickly, and maybe they had been able to get some DNA from a mammoth that was a million years old, but going back to 65 plus million years is just science fiction at this point, as far as I could tell. Go ahead, Anne.
I'm sorry, just jump in to say they've actually been trying to sequence mammoth DNA. And actually, there's a whole push to revive the mammoth. Mammoths, though, are sort of 4,000-ish years old. Like, humans and mammoths actually coexisted. The DNA that you're talking about might have been from a weevil that was about 130 million years old. And actually, that paper was published in the scientific journal Nature in June of the same year that Jurassic Park was released. So there is some work being able to sequence ancient DNA, but you're going to have the whole critter to be able to get enough DNA to do that sequencing. So to be able to extract DNA from the blood of a mosquito that was hardened in amber is almost certainly still impossible, even with today's technology.
But we can just fill in all the blanks with frog DNA, right?
Absolutely. I feel like in that case, what you're going to be creating is a frog with a couple of base pairs of dinosaur DNA versus mostly a dinosaur with a little bit of frog.
They're very different kinds of preservation environments too. Like the mammoths are in very cold environments. They're being kept maybe not as cold as, you know, we keep genetic samples. But when you're thinking about dinosaurs in amber or even in the ground, usually those are very warm environments, and I know that DNA and other biological molecules degrade much faster in those places.
It's a good point. I don't know enough about the different temperatures to know how much that would impact the ability to get DNA from these different organisms.
There was one study that was published that said it could extend it quite a bit. It said the researchers found DNA from the bones halved after about 521 years when stored at 13 degrees, but at minus 5 degrees, the DNA to bone would disappear after like 7 million years. So temperature can play a big role there. And so finding like mammoths in permafrost might be a good approach for finding some of this really ancient DNA. But that's not what they were doing in this movie, right? They had 100 million year old mosquitoes trapped in amber. So that's a very different story. And that to me seems implausible. How about you, John? What was your biggest science gripe with Jurassic Park?
I think for me is sort of an accumulation of little things that kind of bothered me a little bit as you were going through. Things like how long is the genome, right? Which is human one, but not a dinosaur one. Things like, you know, oh, we programmed a lysine deficiency into the dinosaurs. That struck me as very strange. They're like, the dinosaurs can't manufacture lysine. Well, neither can we as human beings, and it doesn't seem to stop us. So as long as your dinosaurs don't eat our food or us, they're fine.
Yeah, they actually address that in the sequel, The Lost World, which I unfortunately watched. It is not a good movie. They just said that the dinosaurs like found lysine-rich foods and ate them. It's like, of course they did. It's not rocket science, right? Life finds a way, as the movie famously says, right? So yeah, speaking of the DNA strands, they do make a big point about how many DNA strands an organism would have during that little sequence when they're on the ride with Mr. DNA telling them about how they made the dinosaurs. And they went to quite a bit of trouble to say, put up a screen with a number of nucleobases on it, and then say, oh, if you looked at a screen like this once a second for 8 hours a day, it would take you 2 years to look at the entire DNA strand. And as listeners of the pod know that John and I love numbers and calculating them and making sure they're right or wrong. And if you actually do the calculation, you'll find that there's 10 nucleobases per packet times 8 per line times 24 lines. Anyways, if you do the math once a second for 8 hours a day, you actually get 40 trillion DNA strands, which is 10 times what they said was in a genome, which is 3 billion nucleotides, which is about what it is for a human. But we don't actually know how many nucleotides are in a dinosaur DNA. It varies by species. I doubt it's 40 billion. That seems excessively long. I think, John, you found one that was as high as 9 billion, but not 40 billion. Is that right?
Yeah, it's kind of weird because the closest living relative to dinosaurs, birds, have some of the shortest genomes of any land animals today, more like 0.9 to 1.8 billion base pairs. And yet frogs, which are the other wonderful creature mentioned by Mr. DNA, they have some of the longest genomes. They average about 4 billion base pairs, and they run as high as 9 billion. So it seems like these are a strange pair of organisms to try and hodgepodge together.
And it just seemed weird that they put such a specific number on this and then got it totally wrong. There's clearly nobody fact-checking this. They did have technical advisors, but they were paleontologists, not mathematicians, I guess. The other very specific claim they make is that just one drop of your blood contains billions of strands of DNA. And both John and I tried to replicate this number. John, do you want to say what you did? And I can tell you how I tried to calculate this.
Yeah, and entertainingly, when we were doing the number of base pairs and how long you would have to read them, we actually counted the exact same number, which I think is a popcorn science first.
Nice.
For this one, we took different pathways. So I was thinking about levels in blood serum and thinking about you've got one drop, which is 1/20th of a milliliter. And, you know, what's in that? I was thinking red blood cells, which have mitochondrial DNA, and white blood cells that have the full DNA strand there. When you add it all up, you know, I'm getting numbers in the millions. And I think you were getting an even smaller number, Catherine.
Yeah, I found a paper that claimed there was 83 micrograms per milliliter of DNA in fresh blood. I assume it's human blood. It was a forensic paper. DNA has a mass. A droplet of blood has a volume. So you can kind of do the math to figure out how many DNA strands are in 83 micrograms per milliliter. And I got about a million strands, at least human DNA would be in there, which is a far cry from the billions of strands they claim in this phrase from the movie. So again, somebody clearly was not doing the math there. That's what we're here for.
Maybe they're trying to evoke Carl Sagan.
Billions and billions, exactly. Yeah, I don't have the Carl Sagan voice, sorry. So I guess the other thing that we should probably talk about are the dinosaurs themselves, because they did make a lot of pretty crazy claims about the dinosaurs they portrayed in the movies. And I see you had some concerns about the T-Rex. Do you want to talk about that?
Absolutely. So I had a ton of fun digging into some of the science behind how do you figure out maybe what these dinosaurs, especially T-Rex, would be kind of good at based on looking at brain structure. So it turns out in our brains, we have, if different regions are sort of larger than others, that would suggest that that is basically going to be a specialty. So animals that can smell really well are going to have large olfactory bulbs. And that's going to be reflected now if we're not looking at the brain, but we're looking at the skull. We can basically get an idea of what the brain is going to look like inside that skull based on the shape of the skull. And I'm waving my hands as we're doing this, you know, Zoom call, because obviously this is going to translate well to the audio for the podcast. And you can actually create what's called a brain cast. So using computed tomography or CT scans without destroying the fossil, which is really cool. And so what scientists have done is they've done these sort of CT scans of the T-Rex brain and found that, you know, to try to get a sense of their cognitive abilities. And what they found is that their olfactory bulbs were pretty well developed. So they would have a really good sense of smell. They also found good evidence for really good quality vision, and their hearing should be really, really good based on, again, the shape of the brain cast that they were able to get from these CT images. So what that would mean is in scenes where people are being hunted by those T-Rexes, sitting still is not going to be a good strategy for avoiding being eaten, because those dinosaurs would be able to smell them and certainly be able to track them that way.
Unless it had a really bad cold. Oh, go ahead, Sean.
I was just thinking that it's interesting. Our experience, you know, with birds is mostly these passerine birds that are in the backyard and whatnot. And they are very visual creatures. They don't smell very well at all. But there are birds that have those big olfactory bulbs that Anne was talking about, primarily, you know, things like vultures and seabirds in particular that travel long distances looking for a compound called dimethyl sulfide that you find in plankton blooms. I've even heard that that particular compound, people want to look for it on exoplanets as a biosignature.
Oh, yeah. I think I've heard that too. Yeah, yeah. Dinosaurs on other worlds.
I know, on Mars even, at least according to Grant's fridge.
Okay, so that's going to be the next sequel in this franchise then?
It follows, logically, I think.
Perfect. We'll look for the royalties.
Yeah, yeah. So the other complaint I see a lot about this movie is the Velociraptor itself, which plays a pretty big role in the film. You can almost, the T-Rex and the Velociraptors are sort of like the antagonists in this movie. But apparently an actual Velociraptor is much, much smaller than what they portrayed in the film. Maybe a foot and a half tall, not 9 feet tall like we saw in the movie. I guess at the time they were basing it on another Velociraptor relative called a Deinonychus. I don't know how to say that, which was a little bit bigger, but he thought Velociraptor sounded more dramatic. But thankfully, right before Jurassic Park came out, there was actually a Utah raptor that was discovered that was even bigger than the film's raptors. So they were lucky that they did find a large raptor while the movie was being made, but it was not a Velociraptor. The other thing is that they probably didn't move as fast as they were made out in the film. At one point, I think they said they could run 50 to 60 miles per hour, but that's extremely unlikely for a bipedal animal like the Velociraptor. All the fastest land animals are quadrupedal, like the cheetah, which can go 65 miles per hour. The fastest running bird, which is the ostrich, can only run between 30 to 40 miles per hour. So they kind of overemphasized how quickly these dinosaurs could move, probably because they wanted them to chase cars and make that dramatic. It wouldn't be very dramatic if, you know, the T-Rex got winded 2 minutes into the chase scene. They really made an impression on people on what dinosaurs look like. That is largely wrong, unfortunately.
Yeah, I think there's a fun little square cube law thing here that as you make an organism bigger and bigger, strength goes up as the square of the muscle area, sort of the area through there. But the amount of mass it's got to move goes up as its cube, right? Like the volume of the creature. And another problem that we've talked about in previous episodes is how do you get air into that? You know, how do you have a lung system that can perfuse all of that that muscle? And it was interesting to me in this movie to see the Velociraptors and the T-Rexes both kind of moving in similar ways. I don't know. And do you have any, you know, insight into this sort of thing?
Well, I've got several thoughts. The first of which would be the fact that all of these dinosaurs pretty much were animatronic. So they're going to all be moving the same way because there's puppeteers controlling them. Side note, I think that is super cool that the amount of technology that went into creating the dinosaurs for the movie. The other thing I was thinking about is there's some really cool kind of adaptation. So like the cheetah biomechanics are really, really cool. They've got some specific adaptations that allow them to get up to those kind of speeds. Then the other thing would be, if we're thinking about, you know, sort of energy usage, yes, we do need to get oxygen into all of our muscles to be able to use that for energy, but we do have other energy sources. So using oxygen is referred to as aerobic metabolism, and then not using oxygen is referred to as anaerobic metabolism. So if I need to sprint to go catch the bus, which I routinely did as a kid because I didn't want to get out of bed in the mornings, I would be using that anaerobic metabolism to get myself down the driveway as quickly as possible. And that's why I'd be super winded because my body's trying to catch up. So you're absolutely right, sort of size and weight and all that changes things. I think it's possible that these animals could move pretty quickly for short periods of time because of that anaerobic metabolism, but wouldn't be able to do that for extended periods of time. And I don't know very many animals that can move at very fast speeds for extended periods of time because it's just too energetically costly.
So we probably can outrun the dinosaurs. That's good. Good to know.
So humans are these super cool endurance athletes when a lot of, again, I don't know, I haven't kept up on this, but a lot of the data are that we were these, you know, sort of endurance athletes and we would just run prey down. So we would run for miles and miles and miles and miles and miles and basically prey would get too exhausted and then we would be able to get our large animal that's going to feed us for the next several weeks.
Exhaustion hunters.
Yes, pretty much.
So the other big gripe I read about online, there's a paleontologist wrote a Slate.com article about the dig at the very start of the movie. And there's some things that are realistic about this, which we'll get to in Science Shine. But I guess they were not a fan of how they were uncovering these Velociraptor skeletons in the movie, this perfect skeleton that they just had to lightly brush sand off of to expose this perfect skeleton. It sounds like what's more realistic is that you find kind of like bits of bone disintegrating out of the ground, and you have to dig down into the rock in order to find a more coherent skeleton. So to find just a perfect skeleton right on the surface is rather unrealistic, if I'm understanding this paleontologist correctly. And then the other thing they made a big deal about was this weird sonar machine, which in the book they call computer-assisted sonic tomography, or CAST. They don't ever tell us what it is in the movie, but that's what Michael Crichton says it is in the book, which also I don't think would work very well in this situation, basically because rocks and fossils have the same density. So anything where you're trying to tell density differences in the rock, it just wouldn't even show up. From what I could tell, mostly they use it to determine the health of tree trunks these days, because I guess decayed wood has slightly different density than healthy wood. And it could work in archaeology applications too, like a pottery shard would have a different density than rock, or bone as opposed to a fossil would have a different density. But in this case, it doesn't seem like it would work at all.
Yeah, I was thinking of seismic tomography here, like the idea that you send a wave through the subsurface and then it's the elastic properties that matter. And you might see something there because the dinosaur bones seem to be a little bit more competent than the surrounding matrix. But at the same time, I mean, Catherine, you and I have both seen a lot of subsurface imaging, and that's the clearest image I've ever seen of something below the ground.
Yeah. Well, myself, I've used GPR, which is a radar technology, not a sonar technology. But yeah, picking out anything from these these techniques is really hard, let alone a perfect skeleton like they saw here.
Goodness. I mean, even radiology sometimes seems a little bit of voodoo to me.
Right. Yeah. Even x-rays of our own bones probably wouldn't look that good. The other weird thing is, why was there a kid at this dig site? Like, I've been on a lot of field excursions, and it's pretty rare to see a child there. He didn't seem to belong to anybody. He was just kind of wandering around this dig site, which seems perhaps dangerous for this child to be all alone in the Badlands.
So I'll just jump in and say, one of the things that I was reading about this is that this kind of spurred a huge interest in paleontology. So maybe this was just their foreshadowing that all sorts of kids were going to be interested in paleontology. So we put these kids on the dig site so they get excited about going out to do this in the future. It's a terrible idea, but who knows?
I just can't see that actually happening in real research, unless it's like somebody's child and they couldn't find childcare and they had to bring them along. That's the only situation I could see, but it was clearly not the case, because if another scientist was threatening my child with a velociraptor claw, I might be like, hey, dude, chill out, rather than just watch him terrify my child.
Not the most realistic audience surrogate that we've ever seen.
Yeah. But luckily, they've got plenty of private funding from Hammond to do their work. John, I think you did some calculations to figure out how much money Hammond would actually be contributing to them in 1993 dollars. What did it turn out to be?
Yeah, that was my question. You know, but do they get that much funding? So Hammond talks about he's supplying them $50,000 a year, which is in today's dollars, something like $112,000 a year, which is not bad. Like, totally, you know, you can do some good science with that. But these kinds of digs, I wonder, you know, depending on how long your field season goes on, how many people you have, how you're reimbursing all that, you can spend on a field season money very quickly. So I wonder if that really is quite as generous as Hammond seems to imply. I do, however, enjoy that as soon as he reveals himself to be the donor, they just change entirely. And some things stay the same, you know, when it comes to faculty at universities, don't you think?
Yep, we're always desperate for funding. That's for sure. But yeah, I did a 3-week field excursion to Iceland, and not counting people's salaries, it cost like $70,000. So that kind of money doesn't get you that far. So I agree with you, John, that might not be enough to really fund a whole summer of paleontological field research.
Well, before we go on to the things that we liked about this, the science shine, are there any sort of like final quick hits that you all have? Maybe I'll start with Anne.
Oh boy. I mean, certainly, I don't know if it's a science gripe or science shine. One of the things I thought really interesting when I was doing some other reading is we obviously don't know what dinosaurs sound like or sounded like. And so what I found is that the audio for the raptors was a combo of dolphin screams, whale bellows, African crane mating calls, and as well as human rasps. And what they used to depict the sounds of raptors communicating with each other was a pair of mating tortoises. So I thought that was great.
You should read the Wikipedia page. It's just a long list of every weird animal noise they use to represent the dinosaurs.
Yeah, I think I now want to go back and watch the movie again to try to pick up on the mating tortoise calls in particular.
Maybe it's not surprising. I mean, we use the call of the red-tailed hawk anytime you're trying to add audio to bald eagles in any kind of media.
I mean, fundamentally, we have no idea what dinosaurs sounded like. So they did their best, but anything they do is going to be wrong. My last thing is that fence scene where they're climbing over the fence. It's about to be charged up again. It very prominently says 10,000 volts. And then Timmy, of course, gets stuck on this fence and gets electrocuted by the fence. And so I was trying to figure out, could a child really survive a charge of 10,000 volts? And we don't really have enough information because it doesn't really matter about the voltage. It's more about the current. So if there's a small enough current, possibly he could survive. I mean, his heart did stop. So it's not like he was in great shape afterwards. But they had some small dinosaurs there who they wouldn't want to die if they brushed up against the fence. So possibly, but it just seemed a little too convenient. And Timmy seemed like in pretty good shape after getting electrocuted by 10,000 volts. And then the other funny thing I thought is Sam O'Neill, when he was testing to see if the fence was electrified, he just threw a stick at it, which is not a conductor.
Very conductive.
You would not tell if the fence is electrified by throwing a stick at it. John, I think you had a couple of things to say about this scene as well.
Oh, goodness. Tim is just a walking disaster when it comes to, the science.
He should have been very dead. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. With the car falling 60 feet while he was inside of it and it was, full of pointy objects and he wasn't restrained. That's not great for anyone, especially not kids. And using, thermal IR glasses inside a car where automotive glass is actually designed to block those wavelengths. So I don't know. Questionable choices with that kid. So maybe we'll stop it here for the science gripes, and we'll be back in just a minute with the science shine. All right. So welcome back. We're taking a look at Jurassic Park this week, and now we're getting on to the things that we liked about the movie. So Catherine, was there something that really stuck out to you that you want to really give them kudos for?
Yeah, I thought they did a pretty good job about talking about dinosaurs as related to birds, because that was pretty modern for 1993. There was still quite a bit of contention about this point, is my understanding at the time. But they had a paleontologist who was helping to advise them that was pretty on board with this idea that dinosaurs were related to birds. And they really leaned into that in the film. And it turns out 30 years later, that's pretty much the scientific consensus these days. They call it the dinosaur renaissance. This idea that dinosaurs were warm-blooded, active, intelligent, genetically related to birds, which, was in sharp contrast to previous depictions of dinosaurs as being stupid, sluggish, more like cold-blooded reptiles. But that's not how they portrayed it, even though there was basically very little evidence for winged or feathered dinosaurs at the time. Those discoveries weren't made until the late 90s. They suddenly started discovering more evidence of feather imprints on dinosaurs. Previously, the only evidence they had was from like one feather from 150 years ago. So they were really, I think, ahead of their times in predicting this connection between dinosaurs and birds.
There was a conversation about actually including feathers on the dinosaurs, wasn't there?
I do remember reading something about that. Yes, and I think Velociraptors and some of the sequels started to have more feathers because of that.
Yeah, they definitely included in the sequels. I didn't read about it for the original. Like I said, it was pretty out there at the time to think of dinosaurs as feathered, although there was more and more evidence leaning that way.
Plus, maybe they would be less scary if they had feathers on them.
Look at that cute little chicken. Yeah. I don't know. How about you, John? What was something that stood out to you?
Well, I did like all the little things that they got right. I mean, I know we picked on them about the length of the DNA strands in the last section, but 3 billion is actually the correct number in our DNA. And there's other little things like that, like dinosaurs are indeed found in the Badlands. I mean, I think that's really nice that they, you know, brought that kind of tradition out. All sorts of little interesting things that are, you know, maybe a little bit more science-y than science sometimes, but it's really kind of neat. And one thing I enjoyed, which is not so much science, is just the way things are, was that they go through the ride and the animals just keep failing to show up.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, oh yeah, it's just like a real zoo where you go up and the animals are, I mean, I guess at a zoo, they are there for your entertainment, but they're not required to be at the front of the enclosure, you know, introducing themselves. So I kind of like that little bit.
Yeah, that was a change from the book. In the book, when they go on the tour, they do see quite a few dinosaurs, but I really liked how they did it in the movie because it did seem a lot more realistic from my zoo experiences. How about you, Anne? Did anything stand out to you about, you know, things they did right with this movie?
It's a really good question. I think I'm pretty grumpy about how poorly they did some of the science behind getting the DNA to make these dinosaurs. But I think the fact that they're talking about genetics and how to sort of do some cloning. There's other cloning that was going on at the time. And that there's, you know, certainly insects have and other creatures have been embedded in amber. So while the science wasn't necessarily accurate, I can hope that it maybe spawned some interest in some of these things in genetic engineering. Good things have come from genetic engineering, and good things have come from sequencing older and older samples of genetic material. So I think maybe that's what I'm going to say, just this idea that we have inspiring people maybe to do some science.
While the idea of getting dinosaur DNA from mosquitoes is kind of ludicrous, there are mosquitoes trapped in amber that are over 100 million years old when dinosaurs lived. So that was realistic. And John, you found something about the sex of the mosquito being a goof, but maybe that was okay. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because one of the places I went very quickly is, you know, okay, was there even mosquitoes back in those times? And it turns out that there are mosquitoes, at least from the Cretaceous period, also likely from the Jurassic period as well. So the version of the movie that I saw when I was rewatching, which was on, this is not sponsored, Amazon Prime, they have a little thing on the sidebar which gives you trivia and who the actors are, and they identify this goof that the movie made because they have this mosquito trapped in amber that they drill into during the Mr. DNA sequence. And that mosquito is a male mosquito. And they say, aha, modern day mosquitoes, only the females drink blood. So this is a goof. But as it turns out, older mosquitoes are thought to have, you know, drunk blood, both males and females. There's a little bit of hand waving there. Modern mosquitoes are only about 73 million years old. So, you know, they could bite the T-Rex, but, you know, not like the Dilophosaurus. There are fossils of mosquitoes that now go back 130 million years, and the molecular evidence suggests that they might have been around as far as 220, 230 million years ago. But it's actually more credible than was believed at the time when the movie was made, so they have been vindicated for their foresight.
That's right, another area where they were ahead of their times. Another thing they said, which I thought was pretty advanced for the time, was Tim's description of the dinosaur killing impact. So I think we've probably talked about this before on the pod, but 65 million years ago, there appears to have been a very large impact that hit the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico, the so-called Chicxulub impact, which we think probably had a role to play in the extinction of the dinosaurs. It might not have been the only reason they went extinct, but, you know, it was a pretty devastating impact. And they describe it pretty well in the movie. And this was a pretty new idea at the time, although they knew there was this weird iridium anomaly in the fossil record around this time. The crater itself was only identified in 1991. So this was pretty contemporary based on the science of the time. And they get the timing correct. So I thought they did a good job explaining that part of the movie.
Oh, definitely. I mean, the Alvarez theory comes from the 80s, if I remember correctly.
That's
and
right, yeah.
There's some steam there and I remember there's a lot of popular interest about that particular theory. Although I have to say in the movie, it just rubbed me the wrong way when Grant talked about the T-Rex having accumulated 65 million years of gut instinct.
While it was extinct.
While they were extinct? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it can happen. A couple other things that I thought were reasonable was the scene with the sick triceratops, where they talk about Melia toxicity, which is just the scientific name for the China berry tree, or as they call it in the movie, the West Indian lilac. It is a tree with berries that is toxic to cats, dogs, and horses, so it seems reasonable that it would make a dinosaur ill as well. They don't ever explain why the dinosaur is sick in the movie, although Laura Dern is puzzling it out, but she never comes to a conclusion. But in the book, they make this big deal about how the dinosaurs need to eat rocks to break down their food in their stomachs, and as they're barfing up their old rocks and eating new ones, they get the berries stuck in with the rocks, and it makes them sick every 6 weeks or so. And John, it sounds like you did a little Googling about dinosaurs' digestion.
Yeah, when you told me about the rocks business, I immediately thought about birds, and they have an organ, a part of their digestive tract called the gizzard, which is where rocks work to break down difficult things to eat because birds don't chew their food. They have beaks for the most part. And the idea that, you know, okay, maybe dinosaurs are like birds. Maybe they have gizzards, and these are called gastroliths, these stones. Maybe they have that too. So I decided, okay, let's take a look, because, you know, one of the nice things about a stone in the gut is I bet that fossilizes really well. And it turns out it does. And you do actually find in a lot of the sauropod dinosaurs, you find that there are gastroliths that are preserved within the rib cages of these creatures. So count another one for the bird similarity.
There you go.
I was just going to say, I think I didn't even bother to think about, oh, why is this dinosaur sick? But I'm so glad you guys dug into that, because that is really kind of cool. And now I want to go look more about dinosaur GI tracts and what other things I can find.
Yeah, it's strange, because like you can see Laura Dern puzzling it out, and she gets like most of the way there, and then they just drop it and they never return to it, which I thought was kind of weird. So I'm glad they did expand upon it in the book, so we're not all left wondering what the heck was happening there.
It's a strange misstep, I think, in terms of the way that the movie behaves tonally. Like in rewatching it, because I hadn't seen this in decades, I was really struck by how efficient the movie is. You know, there's tension builds, tension release, and then immediately starts building again. But this sequence here, it sounded like they had something they wanted to do with it. But then, like you say, they just sort of forgot about it.
Yeah, it's a shame. Another thing, and maybe you can comment on, I mean, clearly they used the frog DNA to fill in the gaps of the dinosaur DNA as a plot device, right? They wanted the dinosaurs to switch sex so they could breed and nature can find its way. But it does seem like there is some evidence of this happening in nature, of frogs switching sex, generally in, I think, in the larval stage, not typically as adults, but it does seem to happen in nature. And do you know anything about this?
I don't know a ton about this kind of sex switching, although you're absolutely right, it does happen. And there can even be examples of animals reproducing asexually. And I'm blanking right now on what examples those would be. Probably, again, other reptiles would be my guess. So it definitely does happen. And I think it's a way of ensuring that these species end up continuing to be around. I'm just thinking now that I've read something as well about, like, I think water temperature can affect whether or not animals, maybe it's fish, and I could be totally making this up, whether or not they become male or female. So one of the issues, again, around with climate change is that this is now going to change the sex ratio of some of these different species.
Well, fortunately, we don't have an island full of dinosaurs to worry about, at least that we know of.
This is a good point.
And just one last thing I want to bring up, because I do love Jeff Goldblum, and he's a fun addition to this movie. I don't know exactly why they were so obsessed with chaos theory, although it was very popular in the 80s. But I thought they did a reasonable job of explaining what chaos theory is. This idea that some complex systems are just very, very sensitive to initial conditions. And so it's very, very hard to predict how they're going to change in the future. This is why weather forecasting is so difficult. You basically cannot trust a weather forecast more than a few days in advance because of this chaotic nature of this complex system that is weather. It doesn't matter how big your computer is or how sophisticated your models are. It's just chaotic and you can't predict it. And I thought Jeff Goldblum and the writers did a generally reasonable job explaining this in the film. John, what did you think about this part?
Oh yeah, this is not a specialty of mine, but I did enjoy that side of things. And of course, when you're talking about Jeff Goldblum, he is the agent of chaos in this kind of film. And in many of his roles. And in this particular case, he really is, oddly, for what is really kind of a distasteful character, in my opinion, he is kind of the conscience of the film, right? Because mm-hmm. he's the one bringing up this idea of you're creating forces that you cannot control. And we see flashes of this all over the place. I mean, I think both of us caught the photo of Oppenheimer that, you know, is attached to right. Nedry's computer, for instance.
Yeah. Yeah. So he's in the book, Ian Malcolm is a character in the book. I think chaos theory was just really trendy in the 80s. And many of the screenwriters tried to write him out of the movie, but then they cast Jeff Goldblum. And I think it was a good idea to keep him in there because you're right. He does act as the conscience of the film and brings up all these philosophical topics that the paleontologists seemed too overwhelmed to grapple with at the moment.
Although I will admit, I was thoroughly confused about why we're talking about chaos theory and all of these things at that part of the movie.
Yeah, it's a bit of a weird addition, but I'm glad they kept it in.
Well, I think that brings us to the end of the Science Shine. So we'll be right back in a minute with the Of Its Time section.
All right, welcome back. So Jurassic Park was based on a book that was published in October of 1990. It was filmed in the fall of 1992 and then was released June 9th, 1993. So we're talking over 30 years ago. Interestingly, though, even though it was published in 1990, you might think that's a quick turnaround to get it released in 1993, and you'd be right. People were all over this book, bidding on it before it was even published. I guess Crichton just wanted it to be made well, so he set a flat fee of $1.5 million and then just asked studios to bid on it. And I guess he'd been chatting with Steven Spielberg, who ended up directing this film, about another screenplay, which eventually turned into the television series ER, so they kind of knew each other. So when Universal Studios proposed to make the film with Spielberg, Crichton accepted their offer. Although I found out later that James Cameron made a pitch just a few hours after Spielberg and wanted to make a very different movie, much nastier, as he called it, similar to his 1986 film Aliens. I can't imagine. Can you imagine Jurassic Park like Aliens? That would be a very different movie.
Oh, definitely. And, you know, for fun, let's throw Jim Carrey in there playing
That's right.
Malcolm.
No, I definitely. That would have been very weird. I'm very glad they cast Jeff Goldblum. Can't imagine Jim Carrey is that character.
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
It'd be a different movie, that's for sure.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think Spielberg struck the right balance. You know, it was a scary movie, but one that children could still watch. And I think, John, as you noted, you know, a big part of it is telling, not showing, right? You want to keep the dinosaurs hidden until you absolutely have to use them. So in this 2-hour film, they're only on screen for 15 minutes. Right? The idea of the dinosaur is much scarier than necessarily the image of a dinosaur. Although this was very advanced in terms of its audiovisual effects. This was one of the first movies to use CGI, which was a big deal at the time.
I wonder if part of the reasons the dinosaurs were less on film is the amount of effort that went into, like you said, all of the CGI, but also the animatronics for basically running the dinosaurs. It sounds like the velociraptors, for example, they had one model that had a tail and one model that didn't have a tail. Mm. And in the scenes where there was no tail visible, they would use the tailless one because they needed four people to control the tail of the velociraptor. And it sounds like that sort of infamous kitchen scene was probably one of the more challenging to film. And it sounds like the people who are filming had to be really careful to not have all of the puppeteers on screen. And I guess another reason I want to go back and watch it is that as they were filming that, they would have only one animatronic velociraptor at a time. The other one would be taken care of through some other means. So I just wonder if part of the reason they had the dinosaurs, yes, it worked well for a, you know, sort of plot, as you're saying, but also it's a huge amount of work to have those.
For sure.
Oh, yeah. They blended together so well. I have to say, when they're going by the T-Rex paddock and doing all of those daytime scenes on the tour, those are all shot in Kauai. But, you know, when darkness falls, they're doing all of the animatronic shots in a studio. And I don't know, it just blends so well. So, I mean, they really been very economical about when they deploy these things. You know, the nice herbivorous dinosaurs to awe the audience and then hiding the more carnivorous ones to frighten them later on.
Yeah, apparently they had a lot of trouble with that T-Rex animatronic because it was very rainy during that scene, and they hadn't taken that into account when they were building the animatronic, that, you know, the latex would soak up all that water. And so this dinosaur animatronic would just twitch randomly and scare the cast and crew because it was a lot heavier than it was supposed to be and wasn't working properly. So, you know.
It is neat. I wonder if this is one of the earlier examples of having CGI interacting with live action in the way that it does. Like, there's one scene that really struck me, the T-Rex chase of the Jeep. And there's one point where the T-Rex gets really close and sideswipes the Jeep from the side, and you see the damage in what appears to be a continuous shot. So, you know, for the time period, you know, little touches like that, I think are impressive.
Yeah, no, it was really groundbreaking for its time. And I think one of the VXF folks said, you know, I'm extinct. I'm extinct now. You know, nobody's going to need my services anymore. Although this is one movie that really blended, I thought, you know, that the real animatronics with the CGI very well. So it makes it look a lot better than it would, I think, compared to some of the all CGI projects they did in the early 2000s, which you watch now and just cringe. This holds up a lot better.
So also sort of positioning it in its time here, I think, you know, we always point to the clothing and, you know, I look at our friend, the lawyer here, big lapels, the baggy dress pants, you know, it feels very early 90s. And I think you noticed a few things with the kids' clothing.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm about the same age as Lex, and it just really brought back memories of all the brightly colored, you know, hats and shirts I wore in the early 90s. These fluorescent colors were very popular and just like all smashed together in a really unappealing way. But yeah, that's what things look like in the 90s. I noticed a lot of the souvenirs at the theme park too were also very bright. The 90s loved bright colors, especially the early 90s. And you really get a sense of that in this movie.
I had a pair of bright neon green fleece pants that I wore nonstop around that time.
Oh yeah. Yeah. So much fluorescent.
So I've got to say though, it's kind of fun that Mr. DNA sequence, people still go back to that. Like when I was down in Florida a couple of years ago, going through the airport, they're still selling Mr. DNA t-shirts.
Really?
I'm not kidding.
Wow.
It's still a thing. And there's that interesting interplay between, you know, theme parks and movies that starts to come around at this time. When the theater for Mr. DNA, when it starts to move and it becomes a ride, it made me immediately think of this interesting ride that was going on at the time at Epcot down in Florida called A Universe of Energy. And it was sponsored by Exxon, of course. And in that one, what happens is you go and you go into a theater and you watch a film about, you know, paleontology and dinosaurs and whatnot and how that creates, you know, oil reserves. And then suddenly the theater breaks up and all of the individual rows start to go in a ride. So when that happened in this movie, I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, you got that little bit of theme park magic. And of course, you know, you got to love Mr. DNA. It solidly, as you said, Catherine, places the movie in 1957.
Yeah, it's almost before its time. It seems like an earlier sort of animation than something you'd see in 1993. But then again, this park was built by John Hammond, who's an older gentleman, so maybe he was hearkening back to his youth in this scene.
There's a lot of little touches here that we always pick on, you know, the use of computer screens in movies and whatever's really, really popular. Like we had the VR geneticist, for instance, and wearing a face shield for no reason, just to make things look cool.
Yeah, and this definitely looks like a control room from the 90s with the giant CRT monitors and the floppy disks. But Anne, you noticed something about this movie that was unusual for its time. Do you want to talk about the screens they had on camera?
Right. So they were actually displaying actual computer monitors. And this, I think, is the first time that they're able to do that. I guess normally the refresh rate of those computer screens makes them flash. So what they did is they turned down the refresh rate of those monitors to 48 hertz, and that allowed them to display the actual computer monitor rather than doing something else for that
for that very realistic Unix system they were using. Yeah, that's not what Unix looks like, unfortunately. But
my image of computer programmers at that time has been totally crushed.
Yeah. Although, John, you had an interesting point about the Nidri character and how you thought that fit into the time.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. So the character Nidri that Wayne Knight plays is just such a crazy stereotype. Like, he's shamed for his weight, for his food consumption. But they really pump it up. He's eating something in nearly every scene. He's described as a real slob. Somehow all the other programmers around him have missed the mountain of trash that surrounds his workstation. And I feel like this is sort of the picture of, you know, somebody who's a hacker or somebody who's a, you know, a computer nerd back in the early 90s. Of course, now here in 2025, 2026, if you're listening to this, you know, we know that that these folks rule the world in a sense. They have really changed their image over time, but it was almost a caricature back in the early 90s. So that at the time it was meant to evoke the stereotype, now it kind of doesn't fit in the same way.
Yeah, there's a lot of fat shaming, as you said in the notes here, in a way that's to turn him into a villain. And they don't really give him any a reason for doing what he's doing. They go into that a lot more in the book. Basically, Hammond's stiffing him on the money, and so he gets pissed off and looks for, you know, somebody else to fund his work. But they don't really talk about that, except for maybe one line that doesn't really delve into it. So they're really just making him out to be this overweight slob, and like, oh, of course we'll hate him, you know, without diving into his motivations. And so that feels a little bit out of touch with perhaps how we would portray people in the modern day.
He's really kind of needed to move the plot along, right? Because if not for
that's right.
Nidri, does Jurassic Park even happen? And, you know, then Ian Malcolm can't make all of his quippy lines.
Yeah, you noticed something about Malcolm that I didn't quite see, although there is that hilarious scene where he's propped up on the table with his shirt open and his chest out. It's like, how do you look sexy with a broken leg, right?
Oh yeah, but with Ellie in particular, like in the Jeep.
Yes.
You know, when he's explaining chaos theory, it's like, you know, you don't need to touch another person that much.
Well, and I'm surprised Grant was like okay with that. If they're actually in a romantic relationship, he was, you know, Malcolm was fawning all over her and Grant was oblivious to the whole thing. Maybe they didn't have such a strong relationship. I don't know. And of course, that was you know, a pretty large age gap there. Laura Dern was 20 years younger than Sam O'Neill, so I think they were trying to make her out as older than she was in the movie. Mm. But yeah, another classic 90s trope.
To me, they looked not too different in age on screen. So it's interesting how people can look or be made to look different ages based on makeup and other things in the movies.
It is interesting, a rare case of a young female character or a young female actress in a blockbuster movie being made to look a little bit older.
Good point.
That's right. And she would have had to have been to be a doctor, right? I mean, so I think Laura Dern was 25 or 26 when they made this, which is pretty young to have a PhD. So she probably would have had to be a few years older at the very least to be at the place in her career where they made her out to be in the movie. All right. Is there anything else here you want, any Anne or John, you want to point out that really placed this movie in its time?
I mean, I think I did say this earlier, but the fact that this movie came out right around the same time that Nature paper came out with sequencing this ancient weevil DNA, I think that was sort of the thing that was really, really popular at the time, or kind of the forefront of science. So it's kind of cool that this is both sort of happening at the same time.
Well, and this did seem to kick off a lot of paleontological research, too. I think it did inspire people perhaps to look in areas they wouldn't have otherwise. So it did have an impact there, which we'll probably talk about as we wrap things up.
I have to say, before we started this podcast, I had this impression that when you're talking about like crime shows, there was a lot of stuff ripped from the headlines. But we found a lot of science fiction that was really topical at the time that it was made, and people were rushing to turn it into an interesting story to tell people. So I think that's a nice touch.
Yeah. And just before we end this section, I cannot not talk about John Williams and his excellent score. He was really a staple of the 80s and 90s. And every time I hear that soundtrack, it just takes me right back to this movie. So thank you, John Williams, for your wonderful music and all the band music I played as a kid in junior high.
Me too. It must have been a common experience at the time.
I was in band and I don't remember playing that, but I do remember struggling through learning Dune. So maybe I need to go.
Oh gosh, you needed a better band director.
Yes. Yes, I did.
All right.
Well, we'll be right back in a minute with the rating section.
Right. Welcome back, everybody. So this is the part of the podcast where we rate the movie on its scientific accuracy, on its influence, and how it holds up over time. And now we've got three people to rate it. So I usually start with John, but Anne, how would you rate this movie in terms of its scientific accuracy?
Well, I was pretty grumpy about all the genetic side of things and what they thought about, you know, kind of the dinosaur abilities. So I gave it a 2.
Okay. Harsh. John, how about you?
Yeah, I think I might have the highest rating here. I gave it a 4. I was thinking here about how much they got right. And definitely there are some big holes. I can't really give them credit on things that have turned out to be right later on since the movie was made. But I feel like their heart and their expertise is in the right place. It's just that last little bit before the finish line is where they seem to have screwed up a few times.
Well, I gave it right down the middle of 3. I think they did some things really well. You know, the whole birds as dinosaurs as birds, I thought was very forward looking. But then the individual dinosaurs, they really did not represent accurately. And as Anne said, some of the genetic stuff was pretty laughable. So they did some things well, they did some things poorly. So I'm just going to give it a straight down the middle of 3. All right. How about its influence? How has it influenced our society, you individually? What would you give it, Anne?
Well, so I was thinking more about its influence on society, and I actually gave it a 5. I think that it's been hugely influential in terms of the number of movies that have spawned from it, the theme park rides, all of the stuff associated with it. As we talked about, perhaps inspiring other people to look at paleontology. So I gave it top marks in that regard. I guess the other thing I'll add here is that it was the top grossing film of all time for several years after it was released. So I think that also tells you that it was certainly influential from the box office side of things.
All right. How about you, John?
Well, all I can say is, well said, Anne. I am in complete and utter agreement with a 5, and I can't think what to add.
I gave it a 4.5. I think we've looked at movies and TV shows that have been more influential. I'm not sure this quite rises to the Star Trek level of influence, so I couldn't quite give it top marks. But as you say, you know, the fact that my children are playing a Jurassic Park game 30 plus years after this movie came out does say something. The fact that Toronto, a city where John lives and nearby where I live, has a basketball team named the Raptors because of this movie is also notable. So clearly it's had an influence on society, but I couldn't quite give it top marks because I do think there are other franchises that are a little bit more influential on our society.
And that may be simply your bias and your preferences.
Of course. And that's why we have this podcast.
Absolutely. It's great.
All right.
And we mostly agree, but not always.
No, that's true. That's right. And John's a little bit more open with the ratings. I try to keep to the 1 to 5, but John has given us some interesting ratings in the past.
I didn't know I was allowed to go outside of that 1 to 5. I had strict rules.
Well, yes, I'm a rule follower. John is not. We know this. All right. Our last rating. How does it hold up, this 30 plus year movie? What would you say, Anne?
Well, so again, like you pointed out, people are still referencing it. It's been seems to keep coming back in some way, shape or form. So I'm going to give it a 4, that it holds up fine. The science isn't great, but the story is, I think, pretty darn good. The quality, as we talked about, of the film is pretty well done. So hence it gets a 4.
John?
So I also gave this one a 4. The CGI is impressive for stuff that is more than 30 years old. You know, I was completely immersed while I was watching this, you know, on my laptop for the last week or so. And the storytelling is really sharp and propulsive. The only thing that keeps me back from that 5 is just, you know, you can kind of see like the edges of the CGI now that we've seen more of examples of this in the intervening time, but it's right up there, you know, and we've seen this, right? When movies, you know, put a lot of effort and time into using this sort of stuff, they get something that lasts.
Yep, we're all in violent agreement here. I also gave it a 4. It looks surprisingly good for a movie from 1993. And even today, you can get quite immersed in it. And it's interesting, despite all the sequels, and there have been many sequels, this is still the best, the highest rated movie of the series, even though it is the oldest. So they did a good job. It's a movie that will hold up over the ages. And even my kids today can watch it and enjoy it. So good job there, Jurassic Park. All right. Well, until next time, life finds a way.
Popcorn Science is hosted by Catherine Niche and John Moores, with Catherine taking the lead on pre-production, sourcing clips, and writing show notes, and John taking the lead on post-production and sound editing. Artwork for the show is provided by science illustrator Michelle Parsons, while Sean Nock handles web hosting and ensures that our conversations make their way to your favorite podcasting service.